maybe I could talk about what I am not like. That would be a challenge. Thank you for the induction. It's very difficult to talk about what I'm not writing.
Maybe you could tell us about what you're writing then.
Well, okay. Actually, what I want to start with is the case that everybody knows, which is the case of limit curves. So, but actually, let me finish writing this.
Okay. It's the characteristic polynomial of Frobenius.
Yes, so I will define the terms in seconds.
That T is D sub P. Q is just
not one. Okay. All right, the rest of the talk is an exercise for the so what I want to talk about is that is a problem which comes from an easy thing that everyone starts with in a theory at some point. That is, you know, you're looking at an elliptic curve over a finite field. And one of the first things you do when you have an elliptic curve over a finite field is you compute the characteristic polynomial of the Frobenius endomorphism of this curve. And this characteristic polynomial has the form x squared minus tx plus q, where q, that q is this q, and there are conditions on t that you can satisfy. But in fact, this characteristic polynomial depends not on the specific elliptic curve, it depends just on the isogeny class of the field. So really, you can look at every isogeny class of elliptic curves over FQ, you can get a characteristic polynomial like this. So really, you can look at the set of all isogeny classes of elliptic curves over FQ, and you'll get some set of polynomials of this form. And the natural question is, okay, exactly which polynomials do you get? Exactly which T's, that's the only thing that's left up in the air, which traces of Frobenius do you get from elliptic curves over a finite field FQ? And, well, that's the thing I wrote on the left-hand board over there. This is due in some sense to Deuring and in some other sense to Waterhouse. And it's very satisfying, but you can just give it a Q, you can make a list of the possible T's that you can get without too much trouble. But you can also ask similar questions for things other than elliptic curves. So for instance, suppose you take an isogeny class of abelian surfaces. So these are the two-dimensional analogs of elliptic curves. And if you look at the set of all of these things, and again, each isogeny class has a characteristic polynomial of Frobenius. And they look a little bit different. You have x to the fourth plus ax cubed plus bx squared plus aqx plus q squared. So again, there's the symmetry that you get up here, so the coefficients kind of scale as you get to the second half of the polynomial, and really there are only these two integer parameters, a and b, that are left undetermined. So given an isogeny class, you get a polynomial like this, or an a and b. And you can ask, all right, which polynomials of this form do you get from abelian surfaces over a given finite field? And there is an answer, which is similar in spirit to this, but a little messier, and I'm not going to write it down. Knowing the image here is essentially a result of Tate. But you know, this is nice if you're interested in isogeny classes and obedient services, but a lot of people aren't interested in isogeny classes and obedient services. But they might be interested in curves of genus 2. So you can look at the isogeny classes in here. That contain Jacobians. Contain Jacobians of genus 2 curves. So that's a subset. And you'll get some subset of the polynomials that Tate identified. And the question is, what is that collection of polynomials that you get from Jacobians? And because Tate already answered the question of what polynomials you get from obedient surfaces, you can really say, you could take some kind of converse or contrapolite. Gosh, I'm thinking on the top of my head here. Instead of asking what things do you get, you can ask what things here don't you get? And it actually ends up being maybe slightly easier to state. It's still, as you can see, not simple to state what happens. But let me at least guide you through this a little bit. The different entries on this table come from various sources, but the last few touches on this are joint work with Daniel Meissner, Henrik Nart, and Christoph Ritzenthaler. Although this question, what polynomials do you get from Jacobians, worked on by Rook and Serre, and I don't know if you realize that you worked on it, and other people.
Where are those three people from? I don't know them.
Nart's from Barcelona. Meissner was his student and is now somewhere in Mexico. I'm not sure where. And Ritzenthaler just got a job at the Institute for Mathematics in Germany. So the idea is, suppose you have some polynomial which you know already is the polynomial for an abelian surface. And if it happens that one of the abelian surfaces in your isogeny class is a product of looped curves, then that implies that you could factor f as the product of two elliptic curve polynomials. So if you can do that, do it. Then you won't have a Jacobian in the isogeny class. Well, if and only if one of these conditions holds, and there's the case where the isogeny class splits, and then there's conditions on the characteristic P and on the actual prime power Q, the size of your finite field, and there are conditions on the S and the T that appear in the factorization that you have written. And in the case where there aren't products of looped curves in the isogeny class, then you have a different set of conditions. And, it's kind of a mess. But it is answered, which is something. And what I would like to talk about today is about part of the work that leads up to this result. And there are two different aspects to proving a theorem like this. First of all, if there's a polynomial, a characteristic polynomial of Frobenius, that actually does occur, you have to prove it occurs. And if there's a polynomial that doesn't occur, you have to prove it doesn't occur. And that sounds like a trivial observation, and maybe it is, but it really does influence the way you're thinking about things. Because if you want to show something exists, then you start getting involved in, how do you construct something like this and stuff like that. And if you want to show something doesn't exist, then you're more in a framework of just trying to find any contradiction you can. And in fact, in some ways, showing that some of these things don't exist, in some cases, it just seems much easier than showing that some examples do exist. So what I am going to do is give one result, which is kind of the basis for three of the entries on this split case table. I'm going to explain how it is that we know that you don't have a Jacobian if if you have the difference of the elliptic curve traces being one in absolute value. And I'm going to talk about this case where one of the elliptic curves is super singular and the other is not. And I'm going to talk about this case, which is kind of the characteristic bigger than three. This is the really only example of when you can't get to a through product of two super singular elliptic curves from isogenous to a Jacobian. Okay. Actually, one thing that you can notice, both for the elliptic curve theorem and for this genus two theorem, is that things look much simpler if the characteristic is bigger than three. That's just kind of a general principle. And actually, it will come up today when we're talking about the supersingular cases. Okay.
So how difficult is the Tate description of the full set of polynomials for Abelian surfaces?
It's not that difficult. You just have to, it's just, again, that isn't very difficult. It's just a pain to state. And the same thing.
It's painful. I mean, this sort of supplement to the...
So I mean, the first thing you can do is say, well, first of all, if you have products of elliptic curves, that's one class of thing that you get, and then you have to worry about the simple isogeny classes. For the simple isogeny classes, you know, you need all of the roots of this to lie in the circle of radius square root of q, and they have to come in complex conjugate pairs, and then if b is coprimed to q, you're fine, and then if a is coprimed to q and B has large enough valuation so that you get the right Newton polygon, then you're okay. And then the supersingular cases are just kind of painfully. You have to say, you look at this polynomial and you look at its roots in QP and check valuations and degrees of extensions. I mean, it's not hard, it's just not pretty.
When you keep saying not hard, are you referring to the description or the proof?
The description.
Okay. What about the proofs? Your case and Tate's case. How deep are they?
So Tate's is deeper than mine. So the idea of the Tate proof is this thing that if you take the endomorphism ring of an abelian variety and tensor it with ZL, and that injects into the endomorphism ring of the Tate module. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the basis of it. And from that, you can deduce a lot of things.
Right.
And for this, there really are a variety of methods that we had to use to do some of this. Some of it, like this line, just involved trying to analyze when are there principally polarized abelian surfaces in a given isogeny class. That was one whole set of tools. And these two things, actually, I talked about this last year. They have to do with counting how many split abelian surfaces there are and counting how many simple ones. And it's a variety of methods. I wouldn't call any of them particularly deep. Though some of them are surprising.
Okay. Does Tate use just the injection of endomorphism, or does he use the actual Tate projection, which he proved?
I mean, the injection is typical.
The injection is a trivial.
The injection is not. Yeah. So actually, he doesn't need to use the conjecture.
That when you tensor with QL, you get an isomorphism.
Yes.
Does he use that?
I can't remember. I think so.
That makes it easy.
Yes. 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 Okay. Let me start. We're just looking at the split case. So I want to begin by stating a lemma, which actually is kind of a special case of something in a paper that Kristen and I wrote. Suppose you have two elliptic curves over FQ. So E and F over FQ be elliptic curves. Uh, traces of Frobenius, say S and T, with S different from T. And suppose there's a genus 2 curve over FQ whose Jacobian is isogenous to the product of these two things. Then there exists an elliptic curve E prime isogenous to E, and an elliptic curve F prime isogenous to F, and an integer N bigger than 1 that divides S minus T. With the property that the n torsion of E prime is isomorphic to the n torsion of F prime as finite group schemes over FQ.
Does actually, n have to be prime to Q?
I'm sorry?
Does n have to be prime to Q?
N does not have to be prime to Q. And things get actually the most interesting when these elliptic curves are supersingular and n is the characteristic. Then you really do have to interpret these things as group schemes over Q and not just white sets with Galois action.
There also something about the relationship N and C. I mean,
N and C. Well, you'll see something in the
looking back to your table and saying, "Well, if that's one, then there's no problem."
Yes. Yeah. So let me give you the proof of this, because it's actually not terribly difficult, and it's going to be the basis for everything else that I'm going to say. So you start by writing down an isogeny from this product to the Jacobian. And the isogeny has some kernel. And you look at this kernel, and you look inside of it for the largest subscheme that looks like a product of two things that match up with the factorization of E times F. So in other words, delta is the kernel of the map from, delta 1 is the kernel of the map from delta to here down to E via the first projection, and delta 2 is the kernel of the other projection. So then you divide these two objects by these things, and you'll get some other finite thing, and you'll get a product of two other elliptic curves. So E prime is E divided by delta 1, F prime is F divided by delta 2. And that E prime and F prime are going to be this E prime. And the nice thing now is that if you take delta prime and map it to E via projecting E prime, via the first projection, it's an injection. It sits inside there as a closed group scheme. And likewise, delta prime sits inside of F prime. Okay. So now that we have this nice delta prime, we can draw a diagram. So here is our isogeny, our new isogeny. There is the Jacobian. Here is the canonical polarization of the Jacobian. Here is the dual isogeny. Okay. So when you take a polarization like this and pull it back to E prime times F prime, you get a polarization on E prime times F prime. But E prime and F prime were not isogenous to one another. Assume that their traces were distinct. So that means that every isogeny at all from this guy to this guy is the product of an isogeny on E prime with an isogeny on F prime. If you wrote it as a matrix, for instance, it would be 0, 0, and something on the diagonal. And so just a polarization. The only polarization that occurs are multiplication by positive integers. So you know you're going to get something like this for integers n and n. Okay.
So this has nothing to do with finite fields. You could just replace it by the statement that enough are not isogenous.
Yes.
Okay, and then it's over any field.
Yes. Yeah. So what else do we know here?
Can't you get the Frobenius in some quarter?
I'm sorry?
Can't you get the Frobenius morphism in one quarter? I mean, why
not polarization?
Multiplication by.
Because the only polarizations on elliptic curves are multiplication by integers.
Oh, we are leaving the polarization.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because this is pulling back this polarization by.
I see.
So one thing you know, I mean, there's still this delta prime that's sitting up here somewhere. And since delta prime is killed, questions?
She was just asking for the definition of a polarization.
I forget.
A one sentence definition.
No, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's always an awkward thing. Yeah,
don't worry about it.
Okay. So this delta prime is killed going down to Jacobian of C, so of course it's killed going over here. So what does that mean? That means that delta prime, if you imagine it sitting inside of E prime, it's actually sitting inside of E prime n. And delta prime, if you imagine it sitting inside of F prime, it's actually sitting inside of F prime n. Okay. Okay. So now you can say, all right, let's look at the degrees of all these maps here. The degree of this map is m squared times n squared. The degree of this map is equal to the rank of the group scheme delta prime. This has degree 1, and this also has degree rank of delta prime. So now we have the equality of two numbers. But this is at most m squared, and it's also at most n squared. So this tells us that, in fact, there's an isomorphism here. And it also tells us that m had better be equal to n. And so I will erase the m's and call them n's. And this n is the same n that is from the lemma. Okay. So what do we have left here? Now we have, we already have something. We have E prime n is isomorphic to delta prime, which is isomorphic to F prime n. So that's done. Let's see. Why is n bigger than 1? If n were equal to 1, then delta prime would be the trivial group scheme. So this would be an isomorphism. And we would be having, we would be saying that this Jacobian would be isomorphic as a polarized variety to a product of two elliptic curves, and that doesn't happen. So n is bigger than 1. And what about this? Well, all of these group schemes have Frobenius endomorphisms on them. They also have this Verschiebung endomorphism, which is the dual of Frobenius. And on E prime n, the Frobenius plus the Verschiebung is equal to the trace of Frobenius, which is, S. So this is on the n torsion of E prime. But F plus V is equal to T on F prime n, which is equal to E prime n. So that means that S and T are integers that do the same thing on the n torsion of an elliptic curve. So they must be congruent modulo n. And that is this statement. So there's nothing particularly unexpected happening. You just have to kind of write things down and you get this result. Okay. So this is nice because this already explains this line here. If S and T differ by 1, then nothing larger than 1 divides them. That's okay. So priority is this entry upstairs, but S1 is key, can't be equal to 1 if you're going to get a Jacobian. And the other corollary is going to be this line, but it takes a little more explanation. And I should say that this is something that Felipe Volok and a co-author, McGuire, I'm not sure of his first name, in a recent paper, though it also follows from something that appears in this paper that Kristen and I wrote a while ago. So let me give you the proof of that. Okay. So suppose we have S squared equals 4q, and just to keep things specific, let's say that S is equal to twice the square root of q. Yeah, particular q is a square. And suppose we do have a Jacobian. Where E has trace S and F has trace T. Then, well, we might as well assume that the E and the F we have are the E prime and the F prime. And the thing is that we know that when the trace of Frobenius is twice the square root of Q, in fact, Frobenius is actually equal to the square root of Q, the integer square root of Q on so now let's look at F. So the Frobenius on F is, well, since these group schemes are isomorphic, it's going to behave in the same way as the Frobenius on E, which is this integer. So this equals 0 on Fn. And another way of saying that is that this element of the endomorphism ring of F tensored with Q is actually an endomorphism. Okay, so if this thing kills the n torsion, then it divided by n has to be an actual endomorphism. But you can work out what the characteristic polynomial of this endomorphism is. It turns out to be x squared plus s minus t over n x plus square root of q s minus t over n squared. And because, let's see, because we're over on this line of the table, the P rank is 1. That means that because E was supersingular, F is not supersingular. And in particular, it means that the difference of their traces is not a multiple of P, the characteristic. So N is also co-prime to the characteristic. So given that this thing is an integer, and that N is co-prime to this thing, means that n squared has to divide s minus t. So in particular, s minus t is not square free. That's this line of the table. Okay. So to explain the last thing is going to be a little bit change of mood, so this might be a good point to have questions if there are questions. Or... Okay. All right, so to prove this last entry, first, let me say something about what the possible traces are. I mean, it's already listed there in the elliptic curve, zero. So,
well, let's see.
Suppose E and F are supersingular elliptic curves. And suppose that their traces are different even after you square them. And because it will make everything easier and because it's listed on that entry of the table, suppose that the characteristic P is bigger than 3. The first thing you note is that if the characteristic is bigger than 3, and if FQ is an odd extension of FP, then the only possible supersingular trace is 0, and so you can't have S squared and T squared. So if we're in the situation with P bigger than 3, then Q is a square. And in that case, there are some conditions that give you various traces and tell you the size of the isogeny class of elliptic curves corresponding to these various traces. So you can have trace twice the square root of Q, and that you can always get. And the size of the isogeny class, there are various ways of writing this, but I think the shortest one, if not the most enlightening, is P plus 4 over 6 greatest integer minus greatest integer P over 12. That actually is the right result. You can also get trace square root of Q, and the condition is that P is not 1 mod 3. Hopefully that's the same thing that I wrote over there. Yeah. And here, the isogeny class, if you meet this condition, has two elements in it. There, and then there are the negatives. So what we're going to show is that if you take elliptic curves that lie in two distinct isogeny classes of these five choices, then in fact the p-torsion groups are not isomorphic to one another. Even if you can get a Jacobian isogenous to the product of these two elliptic curves, so even if their traces are opposite of each other, it still turns out to be the case that their p-torsion groups are not isomorphic to one another. So the way I'm going to show this is by considering twists of elliptic curves and of their p-torsion groups. And the idea is this. Everything in here they have the same isomorphic p-torsion subgroups. In fact, even more, they have the same p-divisible groups. So if you look at the union of all of the p-torsions, those groups are isomorphic. And if you take an elliptic curve in any one of these other isogeny classes, it will have a twist that lies in here. So what I would like to do is show that if you have two twists of elliptic curves, then their p-divisible groups are also twists of one another, and I want to show that those p-divisible groups are distinct, and even more so that they're still distinct when you just look at them mod p. So what I want to do is look at the twists of a supersingular elliptic curve, and those correspond to elements of cohomology group in this case, because the isomorphism groups are abelian, and I want to show that, in fact, there's an injection from this group to something which is not a group, a want to look at the cohomology set of the key divisible group of E. And in fact, I want to go down to the twists of the P torsion of E. And I'm not going to claim that this is injective, although I haven't worked it out, it might be, but I will claim that this is still injective. And I am going to write down what these things are and show that the ones that you come that come from here remain distinct down here. Okay, so that if you have twists of one elliptic curve, then the P torsions are also non-trivial twists of one another.
So even if you're trying to glue the one, like say the top line to the bottom line?
Mm-hmm. You have to do it along the four torsion, I think.
Yeah, so but, oh, I guess S squared is equal to T squared.
Yes.
I was going to ask about two and three because the differences in terms of different classes have been given by twos and threes.
Yes, so you also need to show, like for instance, if you take something in here and something in there, that the two torsion groups are different. But actually that's easy because here, the Frobenius X as an integer in the two torsion, and here it doesn't. And actually, in all the cases, there's one of them is going to be one of these extremal ones, and then you can see the argument that the groups are different. Okay. So what I need to do is say something about this, and this is where Dieterny modules come in. So. Let me say something about Dieterny modules. I guess I can start saying it over here. So let me set up some notation first before I get into the real statements of things. We have this finite field FQ, which is an even degree extension of FP. My co-authors are encouraging me to use a notation which you can tell me whether it's barbaric or not. So ZP and QP, you know what they are. This is the unramified extension of QP of degree equal to this extension. Yeah, I know. Yeah, there are two of them and only one of me. We'll see what happens. But it is convenient.
Use your wit.
It's the bit ring. I mean, ZQ is the bit ring.
Yeah, it is. But
yeah.
There's already a notation. The wit ring.
No.
Well, but it's a W. I mean, W of
FQ.
FQ. Yeah. It's a long notation. I don't know. Well, I'll continue using this for now because it's in my notes. And there's the automorphism of this thing over this thing, which lifts the Frobenius of the finite fields. And I want to let funny-looking A sub Q be the bit ring adjoined to things. So I'm going to define a ring here. This ring is non-commutative. But I will tell you what the relations are in F and V. FV is equal to VF, so they commute, and the product is P. And for all elements of ZQ, we have F lambda is lambda sigma F, and V lambda sigma is lambda V. So AQ is the ring over ZQ generated by F and V subject to these relations. And in the title of the talk, I mentioned Dieterny modules. So the idea is that given a finite commutative group scheme over FQ, of p power rank. There is a magical way of associating to that group scheme an AQ module, a left AQ module of finite ZQ length. And if you look at the functor, which takes a group scheme and assigns it to this module, I'm not saying how you get that, you get an anti-equivalence of categories. So if you want to understand the finite commutative group schemes of p power rank over FQ, then it suffices to understand the category of left AQ modules of finite ZQ length. When I do things like this, I always hope that I don't need to understand how you move from one category to the other. Just live over here because someone did some work and proved a theorem for you. So, but one thing you can do is if you have a whole bunch of these finite commutative group schemes that are pieced together in an interesting way, for instance, like the p-power torsion of the elliptic curve, then that's called a p-divisible group. And this nice Dunne functor will take p divisible groups over FQ and give you, well, I don't want to say all the conditions, but again, you get a category of left AQ modules. They aren't finite ZQ length anymore, but there are other properties. So if I want to understand the p-divisible group of an elliptic curve, then I can, again, just work in some category of left AQ modules, and hopefully everything will work out. All right. So the problem with trying not to use the definition of a functor is that it's hard to get started. You want to understand some object in this category, you need to know what object it corresponds to over here. Unfortunately, Waterhouse says, what is the Dunne module of the p-divisible group corresponding to an elliptic curve with Frobenius equal to square root of q? So, the p as Frobenius equal to square root of q, and it doesn't matter which e you have, any one of these in the isogeny class, you'll get the same answer. If e is Frobenius equal to square root of q, then its Dunne module is the following, m. So it's module for AQ, which is generated by two things I'll call X and Y that satisfy these relations. F of X is Y. F of Y is P times X. V of X is Y. And V of Y is P times X. So that's about as simple as you can get. You can work out what the endomorphism ring of this Dunne module is. It is the maximal order O in, I'll call it HP. Is this, I mean the unique quaternion algebra over QB. So the endomorphism ring contains some p. And let's see.
So I think if you have a equal polar parcel, you take. Then it's Dunne module is uniquely determined alpha isomorphism by the action of the Frobenius, by the actual Newton polygon of the Frobenius.
Ah.
And this result of Waterhouse probably just follows from the fact that the individual group associated with the LFP curve is just a Barzotti date group, and you understand the action of the Frobenius.
Yeah. That.
Yeah, that's a theorem of Gabriel.
I should also say, if it wasn't clear already, that I don't know anything at all about unit neighborhoods. So if you know something about them, then I will. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I will learn something if you say something about them. Okay. So I want to look at twists of the student A module M. And that means that I want to know something about this thing. And there are a number of nice properties of this thing that make it kind of computable. One nice property is that the Galois group acts trivially on the automorphism group of M, because all the automorphisms of the P divisible group are already defined over FQ. So that's nice. And the other thing is that since this Galois group is isomorphic to Z hat, I mean, you just have to say, what does Frobenius go to? What you have to specify a cocycle, you say, what does Frobenius go to? And as long as it goes to some element of finite order, then it lifts the cocycle of the whole Galois group. So this thing is equal to set of conjugacy classes. Conjugacy classes is because the Galois group acts trivially this end M star, the automorphism group, of finite order elements. So you can ask, what are the elements of finite multiplicative order in here? And any such thing is going to be, well, a root of unity. If you have such a finite order element, you have a zeta in N O star of finite order, then ZP joined zeta will be a field living inside here. And already that tells you some nice things. I assume that P was bigger than 3, and that's going to tell me that the order of zeta, the multiplicative order, is not divisible by the characteristic. Because if it were divisible by the characteristic, this thing would be ramified with ramification index at least P minus 1, and that it would not fit inside this quaternion algebra. So because P is bigger than 3, we know that the order of zeta is coprime to the characteristic. And now we know what cyclotomic extensions fit inside HP. It's just you have the barbaric notation ZP squared sitting inside here. And the roots of unity in here are exactly the roots of unity up to conjugacy that appear at all. Okay. So let's see.
Well, actually, they all do. So all quadratic extensions occur in that quaternion algebra. So
yes,
both ones become roots of unity.
Yes, right. So that says that these conjugacy classes. Well, I'm going to say something here. There's a bijection here between these conjugacy classes and the p squared minus one, p squared minus first. P squared minus first roots of unity ZP squared. And if you like, you can think of these things also as being equal. So there's an equal sign, and there are quotation marks of the elements of F P squared star. Okay.
So in fact, if you take a root of unity in ZP squared and you take its complex conjugate over ZP, then you know that in this quaternion algebra, those things are conjugate to one another. But they're not conjugate to one another in the maximal order of the quaternion algebra. It turns out that to conjugate one to the other, you need to have something of positive valuation. So it's not invertible in O. So in fact, you don't just get conjugate pairs of p squared minus first root of unity, you actually get all of them distinct from one another, which is a nice thing. So what this means is that if I want to give you all of the twists of M, I'm going to have to give you this many of them. And so I will. So for every zeta in ZP squared, I'm going to give you I'm going to define a Dudonné module M zeta. So I'm going to do it as follows. I'm going to pick C in ZQ, whose norm, so norm from Q to P squared of C should be zeta. And I'm going to let M zeta be AQ, the module over AQ generated by a W and a Z, satisfying the relations F of W equals Z. That's nice enough. F of Z equals C, let's see if I can get this, to the, no I can't. So it's C inverse times P times W, and V of W, it's even worse, it's going to be C to the negative sigma inverse. V of Z is equal to P times W. So it's an exercise to check that this is actually consistent and you get a left A module like this, but you do.
But how does it pop out? Why is this a natural construction?
I don't know. I was trying to think of what a twist would look like, and once you specify this, which is reasonably natural, then these things follow from the relations on the divine A.
So here is an idea. This Dudonné module, in the case you are discussing, where A is an analytic curve,
yes,
or any abelian variety whatsoever, yeah, it's also, Grothendieck clarifying the situation, and he said, well, this is H1 crystalline of the abelian variety over W. And there is a way of twisting crystalline cohomology, a natural way. Maybe that's what you're doing here.
It kind of has to be, I think. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
But when you say that there's a... there's always kind of a natural way of twisting anything.
Grothendieck actually defined twists of crystalline cohomology.
Ah, so he said, given this automorphism here as a...
I'm not sure if that's what you're doing here.
I should look that up.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I think I'm going to leave it as an exercise, because it's not very hard, to show that if you move up to the algebraic closure, so that means you tensor with, again, you'll forgive an even worse barbarism. That these are isomorphic as modules over A, B infinity. This is not so hard to show. In fact, if I have time, I'll show it. But the nice thing is that these things are all distinct from one another, and there's an easy way of telling that. And the way of showing that they're distinct from each other is you can recover zeta
from M zeta as follows. So suppose someone gives you an M zeta but doesn't tell you what the subtrue is. So you just know it's one of these. So you pick the T in here with the property that Frobenius applied to T is not in P times M zeta. So you can do that without knowing what zeta is. And if you want to think about it, T is, you know, A times W plus B times Z for some A and B in ZQ, and I guess A is not in PZQ. But we don't know what A and B are. Yeah, I guess we're Bob and Alice knows what A and B are. So it's not hard to check that for all elements of ZQ, we have that F times T is congruent to CVT, modulo multiples of P, if and only if C is congruent to A sigma divided by A sigma inverse times C sigma inverse modulo P. But if we had this relation, then we could take norms and find that the norm from Q to P squared of C is congruent to, well, the norm of this thing is 1, and the norm of this thing is zeta sigma inverse modulo P. So given M zeta, we find a T with this property, we find some value of C that makes this congruence true, we take its norm, and we found zeta up to an automorphism, so we found zeta. So this is telling us that these roots of, well, so all the different roots of unity are giving us these different tutor name modules. And in fact, all we needed to know was M zeta mod P M zeta in order to do this calculation. So this tells us that in fact, on the P torsion part, these things are still distinct. And that was exactly what I wanted to show. I wanted to show that if you had an elliptic curve, say, that was in the Itagene class with all the anamorphisms defined, and you twisted it by a root of unity, then you would be twisting its Dudonnet module by that root of unity, and you get a different Dudonnet module, and those things are still not isomorphic even when you reduce mod P. So. And that is up to the other thing. Joe had mentioned that there are these other torsion groups that might be isomorphic. But in when S squared is different from T squared, you can show that those other possible divisors of S minus T, actually the torsion subgroups of the elliptic curves, are not isomorphic to one another. So if S squared is different from T squared, then you don't get a Jacobian isogenous to E times F.
I guess. Any questions? So I'm trying to think of an obvious computational question. So if you had a polynomial like that and it doesn't and nothing happens in this table, so it should be the polynomial of a Jacobian. Can you find the Jacobian, the curve that it's the Jacobian of?
I mean,
you have all these methods for constructing, so
yeah, but I mean, the general case is that you'll have an ordinary simple, I mean, that's kind of generically what's going to happen, and there, you know that there's a curve just because you can show that there's a principal Lorentz variety. And
I see. That's very hard.
So it's hard to find that. I think you would just have to kind of start enumerating.
Yeah. Okay. So any other questions? All right. So thank you.